this whole thing about terrorists and about axis of evil just tends to demonize a whole country, a whole nation.
We can turn a populace against us very quickly by killing innocent civilians.
So the French are busily sending signals saying we're prepared to consider reasonable offers. And the response from Washington is basically a large finger pointed up in the air in their direction.
That's your money they're spending to send your sons and daughters to war. And in the end, corporate interests will win while fresh new graves are dug on two continents.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, February 20th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The U.S. is awaiting word from Turkey as to whether or not U.S. troops on several ships in the Mediterranean will be allowed to dock at Turkish ports and eventually be housed on Turkish bases. U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell said there may be some creative things we can do to gain acceptance of a proposed U.S. aid package to Turkey, but Powell failed to elaborate, saying only our position is firm and we expect to hear from Turkey by day's end. With the start of the weekend in Turkey, the Turkish parliament has recessed without voting on whether to allow the U.S. to use bases in its territory during the invasion into Iraq. At the White House briefing this morning, White House spokesperson Ari Fleischer made these remarks.
We have not received any official notification from Turkey about whether they will or will not vote it this week. And so this remains an issue that is, at this minute, an open matter that is not resolved. And we'll see ultimately what the Turkish decision is. I'm aware of a television interview in which it was explained that nothing is scheduled. It did not say that nothing would happen. So this remains an open issue. We will see ultimately what the outcome is. It's open.
White House spokesman Ari Fleischer. Within Turkey, experts say that Turkey is not trying to hold the U.S. hostage to simply protect themselves. It's been reported that during the Persian Gulf War, the U.S. promised billions of dollars in support to Turkey but failed to keep its promise. Consequently, the economy of Turkey has suffered tremendously from the influx of refugees from Iraq. Peace Watch spoke with Turkish political analyst Jamal Husek this week.
Actually, some people think that during the Gulf crisis, 10 years ago, the USA couldn't keep its word, its promise for Turkish government. So I think some experts add this amount also to $10 million or $6 billion, yeah.
You're saying that the U.S. government still owes Turkey $10 billion left over
from the Gulf War?
People
think of that,
Is that true or is that just something?
Yeah, actually, I'm not expert on this, but as far as I know, about 300,000 refugees came from southern of Iraq to Turkey, and Turkey received some aid from USA or from some European countries, but that amount was not enough to cover the expense for refugees that time.
Turkish political analyst Jamal Husek. There has been reporting that the U.S. will attempt to convince Turkey that allowing U.S. troops onto Turkish soil will prevent the Kurds in northern Iraq from posing a threat to Turkey. Peace Watch spoke with Vera Saidpour, the editor of the Kurdish Life newsletter, about why the Kurds in northern Iraq might pose a threat to Turkey.
Well, they do pose a threat to Turkey because despite what you hear in the news, and all the from official sources, the Kurds really want independence. For years, this situation has been such that even when they were negotiating with Iraq, whether they called it autonomy or federation, the details of their demands always looked very much like independence. For example, they wanted their own military. Now they have their own foreign affairs department. I don't know any other federation within a country that has its own military.
Oh, so they want independence from Iraq?
The basic demand of the Kurds, even though they're afraid to say it, they all know it, is really for Kurdistan. And so Turkey knows this very well because Turkey has been dealing with them for years, and Iran knows it, and Syria knows it, and Iraq knows it.
Mm-hmm.
So the reality is, you know, what's presented here in terms of rhetoric is not really the same as the underlying reason.
So they want independence from Iraq in order to establish Kurdistan. Where would Kurdistan be? Would it be that swath of land in the northern part of Iraq?
No. In other words, Iraqi Kurdistan is really the heartland of Greater Kurdistan. And it's the smallest of the three major groups. There are about 12 to 15 million Kurds in Turkey, about 3.5 to 4 million in Iraq, and there are about 6 to 8 million in Iran. And they're really the heartland. And what the Kurds have believed is this. Many have gone along with what the Iraqi Kurds have done because they believe that incrementally, if they can get something for Iraqi Kurdistan, it will spread eventually into Turkey. Now, that's what Turkey knows. And that's why Turkey is very, very much opposed to any degree of separation that the Iraqi Kurds have from Baghdad. And the Iraqi Kurds have gone to great lengths in order to assure that they get something. In fact, the problem that they have with Turkey now is that they went along with Turkey and the United States in the just before the Gulf War and made a deal that if they would help Turkey to crush the Kurdish guerrilla movement in Turkey, that they would be assured that they would get the north of Iraq. And so now, because they didn't get that in writing, they got sort of verbal assurances and they went along with it.
But the Iraqi Kurds made a deal with the government of Turkey to crush the Kurds of Turkey.
Yes, they did. And no one, you know, I tried to tell people that in 1991.
Well, now 600 Kurdish clerics in Baghdad have actually allied themselves with Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party in opposition to the Kurds in the north of Iraq and against the U.S. Now, despite having their human rights violations historically violated by the Ba'ath Party. So the picture that you
paint... No, but you know, it isn't that. It isn't because their human rights are violated. The problem is more than 500,000 Kurds live in Baghdad-controlled territory. And the reason they don't take a bus or a bicycle north is because they prefer to live there rather than to live under the ruling Kurdish parties. But nobody reports that. Nobody wants to talk about it. In the same way that over the last decade, in fact, last year, Iraqi Kurds were the major refugees coming into Europe. They outdid the Afghanis last year, something like, I think it was 36,000.
Mm-hmm.
And no one talks about it. Why, in other words, if they're in Baghdad-controlled territory, why don't they take a bike or, you know, or a bus north? Instead, they flee, you know, and they end up drowning off Indonesia or in the Adriatic or smothering in refrigerator trucks in Greece. It's because they have their own problems with the ruling parties.
Final question. Vera, what interest does Turkey have in Iraq that might be used to persuade that government to go against what seems to be an overwhelming opposition to this war that the prime minister faces both from the populace and from the parliament?
Oh, yes, the majority of Turks overwhelmingly oppose the war. Even there was a demonstration in Istanbul, which is essentially a Kurdish city. There were Kurds demonstrating against the war. Kurds, because Istanbul has about 3 million Kurds,
mm-hmm.
and they were prominent in demonstrating against the war. Turkey is a major ally of the United States, and Turkey is on a tightrope now because of its past decisions. Its decision to outlaw the existence of the, you know, of millions of Kurds in Turkey, which is coming home to roost. It's also a decision to go along with the United States as it set up the Northern Enclave, hoping that it would have enough control so that the Kurds would reunite with Baghdad, where it never was the Kurdish aim to do that, even though they would say otherwise, you know, that we want to be part of Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is they know better, but they were just hoping and depending on the United States. Also, Turkey has an abiding interest in Kirkuk because the Turkish Empire ruled that for several hundred years, and they lost Kirkuk in the decisions that were made after World War I. They lost it when they established the international community, established the modern borders of Turkey.
So what might the U.S. dangle in front of Turkey right now with regard to the Kurds that would persuade them to go along with this war?
Well, I think this, you know, you hear on television about the money that Turkey wants, $10 billion in grants and $20 billion in loans. That's certainly important to Turkey, but I think that the major concern of Turkey is what's going to happen inside Iraq with the Kurds, because they just don't want to have that problem overflowing into Turkey. And I think that if the United States offers them some kind of informal control, because even in 1991 when they made this deal, it was the idea that essentially Turkey would sort of guarantee the peace of northern Iraq. The midsection, where Kirkuk is, would actually go to the Turkmen population in Iraq, mm-hmm. because through that, Turkey would be able to get some handle on the oil, you know, and the leftovers would go to the Arabs. The leftovers would be for the Arabs. That really was the initial game. And so now the game? I think that Turkey has to make a decision whether or not it's going to go along with the United States, irrespective of what the United States does.
Zira Saidpour, editor of the Kurdish Life newsletter and founder of the Kurdish Library in Brooklyn, New York. Retired Rear Admiral Stephen Baker of the Center for Defense Information spoke with Peace Watch earlier today about a possible plan B in the event Turkey rejects the administration's final offer. Baker suspects in the end Turkey and the U.S. will sort out their differences and remain allies.
I really do think that we'll be able to, as strategic as Turkey is and as a close ally, we'll be able to use their bases and in some way we'll sort this out. But just saying that if they finally said no, I think that it would pose certainly a serious challenge. General Franks, as the commander of Central Command, has a plan B. He always has had a contingency operation. And so, and I think as well, those plans are being fine-tuned as much as the military has to go through the what-ifs. Certainly that is in the forefront of Central Command now in playing out that option. What would they do with the 4th Infantry Division and all the equipment that essentially is in the queue and the water's right off of Turkey? And in this situation with Turkey, the 4th Division most likely, I would think, end up in Kuwait. And that is, again, would change our strategy and change the initial plans of the war. And those options, I think, are being looked at and replanned right now, just, again, to cover the bases on the what-if. But it, I think, is very important in our strategies that Central Command has looked at to have a multi-pronged axis, and that would require an effort from coalition forces coming in from the north. So in that aspect, I would think that we would go with lighter forces and not heavy armored forces still coming in from the north, even possibly as our CIA paramilitary and Delta Force folks have surveyed the bases in northern Iraq as a possible staging base. That is another option, I think, being looked at. But very important, I think, on the top of the priority list with Central Command is to secure oil fields to prevent a scorched earth policy from Saddam Hussein, and that would include the massive oil fields up in the north. So by one way or another, and that could be a vertical insertion of lighter forces, and probably will be, I really do think that we have to have and will have a show of presence up in the north by coalition forces.
Now, when you say a vertical incision of lighter forces, does that translate into maybe dropping troops out of airplanes or something?
Well, there could be some airdrops, absolutely, and certainly some helicopter lifts. And with airfields or austere runways secured, then the workhorses of the fleet, the C-130s and the C-17s, come in with more equipment and more troops.
So you just said that the oil fields are primarily in the north, or that there are some oil fields in the north. It's my understanding that one of the major oil fields is actually midway in the country.
Well, yes, the oil fields are spread throughout the country of Iraq. However, there are some significant oil fields, both in the south as well as in the north, and some in the west, yes. And I think we have, in watching those very, very closely, in reference to some reports saying that possibly even these oil fields could be wired for being destroyed by the Republican Guard right now.
What about the chances of having the troops brought in by air? I mean, we know that that the U.S. has been bombing Iraq for 10 years from the air, so I would think that that would be a ready option for this scenario.
Well, I think that the Air Force would be extremely active in this scenario, absolutely. And as the bombing will continue from the northern and southern watch folks in preparation for that battlefield, I would think within the first day or two that in the form of air superiority, we will have targeted anything that is a threat to airborne troops, or excuse me, aircraft, and the of course, the aircraft that would carry those troops.
So why is this not part of Plan A? Why is this being considered in Plan B?
Well, it's, again, the heavy armored divisions that cannot be lifted by air is part of the plan, I think, from what I...
Is a ground war preferable to an air war?
Well, no. It's I don't know if preferable is a good word. There will be a massive air campaign, but very quickly, and within a day or two after that air campaign starts off, we have to have quite a few forces very busy and very quickly moving throughout the country of Iraq, again, to secure oil fields, to secure any potential launch areas for Scuds, as well as to press forward to into Baghdad to ensure we decapitate Saddam Hussein and his ability to communicate with anyone.
Now, when you say decapitate Saddam Hussein, you mean that in a militarily kind of...
Well, yes, I mean decapitate, decimate, paralyze. I think the efforts would be within the first several days to very quickly, immediately render any capability for Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath regime to function totally useless and unable to work. So for that reason, again, that requires some troops on the ground, and that is going to be very quickly happening. Certainly, they'll have air protection, but that's why you see amassing of 160,000 troops in Kuwait right now, as well as possibly inserts from the west and hopefully from the north as well, but all part of this multi-axis approach of our strategies.
Admiral, you started out saying that you believe that things will be sorted out with Turkey. Why do you feel so confident about that?
Well, they're a very close ally. They have been for many a decade. And certainly there's quite a few reasons that as the one member of that's trying to get into the European Union, I think that we have a very positive aspect of that, of helping out Turkey as our ally. And as I said, we have been there for many a decade, and they were a very strategic asset in Desert Storm. There's also, and has been for quite some time, and very rightfully so, a major concern of the day after, or of a regime change, or the day after the conflict is over, if there's going to be one with Iraq, on a stabilizing influence for our forces to be in position in Iraq so that Iraq is not carved up.
Retired Rear Admiral Stephen Baker of the Center for Defense Information. As most sectors of the U.S. economy falters in these jittery pre-war days, the defense industry is not surprisingly in for rapid growth, secure in a gigantic $2.7 trillion in spending planned for the next 6 years. Peace Watch correspondent Eddie Becker recently attended the National Defense Industrial Association's symposium and exhibition in Washington, D.C., where he found out just how big of a business the military is.
Okay, get this. It's the height of the terrorist alert, Code Orange in Washington, D.C., the duct tape town, and I'm attending a defense industry conference for the U.S. Special Operations Command for Low-Intensity Conflict, known in this town by the acronym of SOLIC. This is the command that has been tasked with fighting terrorism, rooting out evil. And contrary to what you might think, these folks just sort of opened up to me, and I felt really relaxed. And in fact, it, like, you know, I get more scrutiny getting into my local bar. The convention hall downstairs is a literal arms bazaar of vendors seeking to sell their latest gadgets to the government. I hit it off right away with David Port, who was selling a pair of binoculars that not only could see at great distances at night, but had an internal gyro that kept everything steady, whether your hand was shaking or you were riding in a helicopter. At least that's what he said.
We come to this every year. It's been a good show with good leads. It's a nice variety of active military personnel and what some might call black agencies as well come through here. Dark agencies, ones you don't know the name, nor do you want to know what they're doing or why they're doing it.
The U.S. Special Operations Command, or U.S. SOCOM, or SOLIC, whatever it's called, was created in 1987 by combining a variety of special forces, like the Army Rangers, Navy SEALs, and other kind of covert agencies in one command structure under the Secretary of Defense. SOCOM had been tasked not only to carry out unconventional warfare and fight terrorism, but also deal with weapons of mass destruction, do drug interdiction, civil peacekeeping, psychological operations, direct action. SOCOM is now the recipient of whiz-bang technical help from OPRA, the Advanced Research Project.
When you walk up and down here, if you really talk to some of these people with PhDs, the doctors that actually are involved in the leading edge and cutting edges of technologies, these guys are into some wild, wild stuff. You only see it in Steven Spielberg movies. These microvision people that have the ability to put a small monitor in front of your eye and give you target information, and it auto-tracks targets out there and pictures, lets you know your exact location on the Earth, and it's all coming to you in a little half-inch or quarter-inch visible screen, just like your glasses. It's amazing stuff. And when you think about law enforcement, they have the pinhole cameras that go under doors. They can do vision through walls.
Today at the Naval Undersea Warfare Center, engineers and scientists are developing a revolutionary new bullet that travels underwater. The Adaptable High-Speed Undersea Missile, or AWSM, is fired from an undersea launcher like a conventional gun fires a bullet in air.
At David's suggestion, I went over to talk with Chris Borland and Tom Myers from Information in Place out of Indiana University. They were demonstrating their nifty augmented navigation system.
You're familiar with virtual reality because you've played with a PC a lot. You've looked at the video games. Now what we're doing is taking the objects that are in the computer and putting them in the real environment. So you can navigate through a street. You don't need a street sign. You've got a virtual street sign. A suspected sniper's location.
And you have it instantly, and it's right in front of your eye. And as you're looking at it, you're looking through this screen, and you see all of this data.
Yes.
But despite my enthusiasm, I knew that their information is just as good as what's fed to them by local contacts, who may just want to get rid of their rivals.
We're going to be able to find where targets are and engage those targets without involving collateral damage. We were not going to be causing casualties in the civilian populace.
A lot of this intelligence is based on agents.
It is.
Oh, no, there's
from
lots
one
of
faction all, or another.
Yeah, just look at what's going on right now in Afghanistan. You got those warlords. Yes, you can go out, you can engage a unit and wipe them out. Then you find out that they were just enemies of that warlord.
And there's no technology that can sort that through.
They realize what that problem is. They realize that we are judged by what happens in a country, and we can turn a populace against us very quickly by killing innocent civilians or doing something that's wrong. Well, we don't want to be like that. See, that's not our job. Our job is take the data, hopefully trusted data.
Now, I finally get to try it out. I'm fitted with this Buck Rogers helmet with a dangling glass, and I'm standing there looking through this thing and following the target they've pointed out to me.
Now, you can see a target there.
A target?
Yes, right there.
I see some guy's back.
Okay, you also see the guy's back, but there's a target on the guy's back, essentially, at this point.
He was unfortunate to have stepped in target area.
Oh. They explained to me that they would be working with the government lab to get it perfected real soon. I wished them luck and wandered over to a booth run by Neil Cohn from Cobra Software. They've developed a chemical, biological, and radiological response aid.
What it is a software and hardware bundle that helps you prepare for and respond to chemical, biological, radiological, or nuclear attack. So first you arrive on the scene. You would take down the symptoms of the victims that you observed. Is there vomiting and nausea? What's going on in their mouth? Are they having hoarseness? Then you would hit done, and it would give you what the most probable agent is. This one came up as tear agent. This is comes from USAM RID of Fort Detrick, Maryland.
Let's do the one that there was just recently a use of biological weapons or something in the United States. Why don't we do the symptoms for that, since it's most likely that that stuff is still around.
Okay. I'm not sure what that was. What do you remember the symptoms, or?
I think it was called anthrax, and it came from Fort Detrick.
Oh, okay. Well, there's, well, we can pull up anthrax here. Type in here, anthrax. All right. That's not going to come up, so I'm going to say contains. Nope. All right, so that's not in there. Let me pull it up here. A-N-T-H. Execute search. This might just be, it might not be in here, I think, because this is my demo unit for the water tank. It might not have everything listed in here.
You're actually using this in a situation where there's tons of water that's falling on top of the computer.
Well, this is to demonstrate that it's fully decontaminable. This computer can be put through a dishwasher, it can be submerged in bleach.
Neil eventually found the anthrax in his mega database, but I was more impressed that his laptop was dishwasher safe. The FBI recently dredged a lake up near the U.S. government weapons lab at Fort Detrick in Frederick, Maryland. They suspect one of their scientists was behind the anthrax attack. But I wouldn't be surprised if more Americans think that Saddam was behind those attacks. It's funny how people's psychology works. Upstairs at the symposium, I wasn't able to place my microphone on the speaker's platform, so you'll just have to move a bit closer to your speaker to pick up what he had to say. Peter Props, for most of his 30-year career, served on the operational side of the Central Intelligence Agency, but now is in the private sector and vice president and director of programs at the Washington-based Institute for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence. He describes the tasks that lay ahead.
This conflict could well continue indeterminately. War is a readily identifiable enemy. In this conflict, the enemy wears no identifying uniform or insignia. In wars, there are battlefields and front lines. In this struggle, there are no front lines. In this struggle, the enemy is indistinguishable from friend or neighbor. He lives among us. The enemy is within the gates.
After he spoke, Props was surrounded by questioners. I being just one of them, I was going to ask him what he meant exactly, but then he explained who the enemy was.
The government does not get its message out to the public. It's also why we lost Vietnam. My view is we won, in essence, militarily. Tet, which was regarded as a terrible defeat, wasn't. It was a military victory for us. But because we couldn't play it with the media as a military victory, our enemies seized the initiative and it became a terrible defeat.
And that's what's happening right now.
That's what's happening right now. Again.
We've lost it again.
Yes, information war.
Now, I'm old enough to remember the Vietnam War, and I remember My Lai, the My Lai Massacre, and the Christmas bombing, napalm, Agent Orange, and the destruction of the Bac Mai Hospital. And the slow realization that came over the United States as Vietnam vets came back and spoke of the genocide until a majority of Americans opposed the war and wanted peace, and Congress cut off funding. They cut off funding the war. I didn't see that as a defeat for the United States. I saw that as a victory for the democratic process. The system worked.
We'll have more tomorrow of Peace Watch correspondent Eddie Becker's report from this conference, sponsored by the National Defense Industrial Association. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.